Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
Author Philip Elkins grew up in East Los Angeles with his parents from Ukraine. He was drafted into the U.S. Army in the 1960s and wrote a book about his experiences running from the fire. When he moved to Chico, he became known as Señor Felipe for his popular salsa and as a DJ on radio station KZFR. He has now written a sequel to his first book. It is about how he managed to survive his year as a medic in Vietnam from June 1966 to June 1967. The book is My Year in Vietnam, How I Managed to Survive June 66 to June 1967. Phil Elkins, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, since your book picks up where the other one left off,
right.
And I was so eager, I was so deep into that book that I get to the last page and think, oh, no, he's not going to tell us what happened in Vietnam. So I was delighted when you came out with this book to tell us.
I was hoping you would be. Thank you. I'm glad.
Well, for people who maybe didn't hear that interview or read your first book,
right.
I'd like you to tell us what happened before you pick up in this book. So would you read the first few paragraphs in your introduction?
Yes. Okay. My parents were from Ukraine, which they called Russia, and they immigrated to America, winding up in East LA, which happens to be the Latino section where my three older brothers and I grew up. And East LA also happens to be the largest Latino community anywhere outside of Mexico City. My first girlfriend, a beautiful 14-year-old Latina girl named Rochelle, and she and I were going out for several months, and she had two older brothers named B. Loco and Ricky Bird, and they happened to be in a gang called El Loyo Mara. And a rival gang knifed Ricky Bird to death when he was 15 years old in City Terrace, which was the neighborhood I grew up in, East LA. And Rochelle knew who killed Ricky Bird, and she was in hiding because she knew they wanted to keep her quiet. So she kept away from home by staying at other people's houses, including mine sometimes, and other friends. And she remained out of sight for almost a year. But one night, the rival gang caught up with her and they raped and killed her. I was devastated. And soon after that, B. Loco's head, this was her other brother, was broke open when people who wanted to keep him quiet caught up with him. And 3 weeks later, we moved out of City Terrace in East LA to a nearby town. A year later, we moved back to LA. And soon after that, my next girlfriend got pregnant and we put the baby up for adoption because we were both so young. And I was further devastated, but that's how things were back then. Her name was Marissa. And you read a lot about her in this book. And since when I got back from Vietnam, anyway, before being drafted, somehow I managed to graduate from high school. I took a night job at a factory and went to East LA Community College in the day and kept seeing Marissa, who was angry at me for not agreeing to marry her and for putting the baby up for adoption. I got drafted into the Army at 19, and my first book tells of the mistreatment of basic training, including training as a medic. And that's part of the introduction to my year in Vietnam.
This is Philip Elkins, and he is known locally as Señor Felipe. And he's reading from his newest book, My Year in Vietnam, How I Managed to Survive June 1966 to June 1967.
Yes. So go on.
So you were a draftee.
Yes, I was.
And you went in reluctantly. And what did you expect when you went into the military?
You know, I was hoping for the best. You know, I wasn't exactly thrilled with the life I was living and going to East LA College. I was not doing real well anyway. And so I dropped below 12 units, which kept you from being drafted. And lo and behold, they caught up with me and I got drafted in the 15th week of the semester, which was only 18 weeks long. And I guess that was good because I was flunking out anyway, so I don't know if I was going good, but it kept me from flunking out. And they asked me, hey, do you want credit for that? And I said, no, thank you. And I wasn't doing too well. Anyway, so next thing you know, I'm in Vietnam, and they send me up to the Central Highlands, where a Sergeant Siddell, who was my officer, you know, sergeant, and he hated drafties. And so he would send me and the other drafties out in the middle of pretty unsafe areas. And one day we were out in a place called Dock To, and we were getting overrun. And we thought, this is it. We're going to be gone. And the helicopters came in, and they rescued us.
Yeah. You also include, right after your introduction, a map of North Vietnam Demilitarized Zone and South Vietnam with right. names of places. They're in South Vietnam, and you are a medic, so you get, can you kind of get privileges that the other guys don't?
Well, I was lucky, you know. I mean, I wasn't a combat medic, and I wasn't, you know, infantry, and so my job was to go around throughout different parts of South Vietnam and tell the troopers how to remain healthy and avoid malaria. There was a lot of malaria there, so they had to take the malaria pills, and the plague was pretty prevalent, and also venereal disease. So I would go around and talk to the troopers, and of course they didn't want to hear anything I had to say, but that was my job. So while I was lucky enough to get that job, it was called a preventive medicine specialist. When they didn't need me, they said, okay, well, lay low for a while. Well, you know, okay, so I would disappear.
But otherwise, sometimes we get, particularly from the movies, say that everything's exciting in their battles, but a lot of your time was filling sandbags.
Hell,
sounds
yeah.
Pretty boring.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Catching rats.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah, how to catch rats, right.
Mm-hmm. And, right. Spraying all these chemicals that didn't just get on your target, they would get all over you. And we've heard about Agent Orange, but you had other chemicals. What you were spraying malathion?
Malathion, yeah, DDT, 100% pure. Wasn't even legal in the United States, but we would spray it in Vietnam with no protection whatsoever, not a face mask, nothing. And you would spray it, and it would hit the ground and bounce back and get all over you. And when we were done with the day, it would go on for all day, 14 hours, you could see it all over us. It was white powder, DDT, 100% pure. And it would get in your throat and your lungs. And, you know, here we're supposed to be teaching preventive medicine.
Yes, that's, I see the irony there.
Yes.
And so teaching preventive medicine was, certainly better than what you've just been describing your duties could entail.
Oh, yes.
And absolutely. You actually, your job's a medic when you weren't being called on those
right.
skills. You kind of got to be a stand-up, and well, I'm exaggerating, perhaps a stand-up comedian. You discovered you had a talent for standing up in front of people and keeping them interested, because otherwise they'd be pretty bored.
No, they didn't want to hear anything. You know, you would tell them, look, when you see your girlfriend, be sure and wear your condoms. And they would laugh at that, you know, like, we're not worrying about getting them pregnant, you know. And I said, no, look, there is a disease here that's incurable. And they call it the black clap. And they would get angry because a lot of troopers were black. And they said, why don't they call it the white honky clap? You know, and I said, no, you don't understand. You can't get rid of it. And this was 1966, 1967. And, you know, I believe it could have been HIV or anything, you know, it was incurable. And they didn't want to hear that. But, you know, my job was to tell them that. And all kinds of other venereal diseases as well. And of course, you know, like I said, they didn't want to take the malaria pill. It's going to make them, you know, gave them diarrhea. So, you know, when the troopers would get sick, you ask them, are you taking malaria pills? No, we wouldn't take that. You know, it's kind of like today when people don't want to get vaccinated. It's like, you know, they think it's not going to help, or it's not a good thing, whatever. But, you know, so I realized the way to get these guys' attention was to be funny. and say ridiculous stuff and make them laugh, and they'd tune in, and maybe they'd hear something I had to say. But, you know, you couldn't guarantee that.
Well, and then your skill was recognized by the people who made these assignments and said, hey, this guy, Phil Elkins, this guy's pretty good at this, at telling the troops what they need to do to stay healthy. And so they would even ask you to train other guys. Hey,
oh, they did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the other guys think, well, I didn't have anything to teach them, so they don't want to hear it. You know, you know, there's this attitude that everybody just wants to count your days until you go home and forget everything. And you know, they don't really want to hear what other people have to say, even if it's for their own benefit. But, you know, so I realized, yeah, make them laugh, you know, entertain them. Then maybe they'll tune in.
My guest is Philip Elkins, a.k.a. Señor Felipe, back when he made salsa
right
locally. His book is My Year in Vietnam, How I Managed to Survive June 1966 to June 1967. And so far from what you've said, Phil, people will say, oh, well, so he survived filling sandbags and lecturing troops on health.
Right.
But when did he see any action? So I would like you to set up what happened.
Right.
You were, you mentioned this, the guy that you were working under.
Right. Fidel. Yes, Fidel. Right.
And so, yeah. So what happened that kind of was an eye opener for you?
Well, he would send us out in these dangerous missions. You know, he was an alcoholic and he hated draftees. He was a lifer and he, you know, wasn't much higher ranked than we were. I eventually became a specialist fourth class, which is like a corporal. And he was, you know, he was a couple of grades higher, but he hated draftees. He didn't hide it. So he sent us out one day to a place called Doc Toe. What's a little small place? And we're getting overrun. And we're calling in for choppers to come in and rescue us. And so looked like it wasn't going to happen. But do you want me to read that part of the book?
Yeah, because you suddenly hear these choppers overhead and you can see these red tracers flying, looking like fire. And you say, it's getting quieter and quieter. So, yeah, would you pick up there after these rocket explosions?
Right. They came in and fired the rockets. And then one chopper went down and crashed. And pretty soon it's really quiet and eerie. And the early morning light seems surreal, peaceful, and sad and depressing. But I see the burned up chopper on its side. And the blades torn off and smashed up and burned black and still smoking. Four men must have lost their lives only a few hours ago, saving us. The realization is wrenching and guilt-inducing. I feel lost, want to throw up. Did they die rescuing us? Why did they have to die? And we were so grateful that they came to help us. They saved us, but did they have to be here? Did we have to be here in the first place? And so pretty soon I get angry and I could feel myself burning up inside. We knew something wasn't right. And I couldn't help myself from crying. And I want to go home. I felt like I've been in Vietnam long enough, been here forever. I just want to go home, see my family, my friends, my girlfriend, my brothers, my mom, my dad. And I am counting the days and I've been here almost 5 months now. And I could, how can I take another 7 months of this madness? Because I'm supposed to be there for a whole year. And I don't see how. Should I have gone AWOL after all when I got the chance in Hawaii on the way to Vietnam? I could have jumped off and just gone AWOL then. Or before that even, should I have never even gone to take my physical exam? I began kicking myself for trusting the government enough to take this chance. It would have been so easy for me to have gotten killed last night. And for what? What are we doing here anyway? I developed an attitude that's hard to keep to myself. I resent being put in this situation for an absolutely some no ridiculous reason. But, you know, I don't understand it, and I don't believe in it, and I don't belong here. And especially Sergeant Siddell's command only makes things much worse. And I'm relieved about surviving last night, but I'm angry and upset about it, too, and I'm still shaking.
This is Phil Elkins reading from his book, My Year in Vietnam. And you mentioned this guy named Saddell.
Right.
And you say that being under his command only makes things worse. And you came to words with him. He ranks above you, and you're standing up to him.
I did, because I got, you know, everybody felt like this guy didn't know what he was doing. He was risking our lives, and he probably had a death wish himself because, you know, he was middle-aged, he was an alcoholic, he was way out of shape, and he hated us drafties. And I think, you know, he got an adrenaline rush going out. It was not safe there. They told us it's not safe here. You know, but he would do that all the time. And that one incident I just read, that was just one, but he did it frequently. And, you know, after a while, you just think, well, sooner or later, not going to make it. But yes, we almost got into blows, and I reported him. And eventually they broke up the unit up in the Central Highlands and up in An Khe. And I don't know what happened to him. I think they sent him down somewhere else out of the way.
Yeah, you're just getting ready to say nobody liked this guy.
Oh, no, they didn't. They did not like
him. In fact, it seemed to me that after a while, you almost not defended him exactly, but kind of came around to seeing, well, you know, he's had it rough. And you became to be a little more sympathetic to this guy that everybody hated.
I felt sorry for him. You know, he had nobody. You know, he was an alcoholic. He was way out of shape. And I think he resented. You know, we didn't hide our, you know, the way we felt about the Army. We didn't like it, you know. And it was his life. You know, it was his career, his chosen career. And you know, we let him know that, you know, we belittled him behind his back, not so much behind his back.
My guest is Phil Elkins, and he has written a book, My Year in Vietnam, How I Managed to Survive June 1966 to June 1967. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, former medic in the U.S. military, Phil Elkins, and he has written a book, My Year in Vietnam. Well, you guys needed a morale booster, and so you get this announcement that looks like we've got some entertainment coming in for the troopers. And that's great. Wow. Who? And this guy you've just been talking about replies, who does he say is coming?
Yeah, you know, so they're not telling us it's a secret. We're going to go in to see the USO show. And we thought, oh, okay, cool, man. You know, maybe be a Nancy Sinatra or you know, see the girls dancing. All right, you know. And so then we find out it's Roy Rogers. And we think, Roy Rogers?
Well, so this is little Fidel.
So we don't want to see Roy Rogers. But lo and behold, he put on a terrific show, he and Del Evans, and he was modest. He had a great voice, you know, and Del Evans, his wife, would push the mic closer to him because she wanted people to hear him. He had a great voice. He put on a terrific show. They did. And, you know, after that, I respect him a lot more. You know, it was like Roy Rogers show, something you watch as a kid. You think, oh, no, what is that? But no, he was great. And it was, you know, I saw another USO show later on, closer to Christmas, and that was Bob Hope.
Before we get to Bob Hope, though, right. Example of how seeing Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, you say you spent the night camped out there, you wake up early, you right. watch the choppers flying overhead, and you were singing to yourselves and yodeling and yeah. hearing Roy Rogers and Dale Evans' harmonies in your heads, smiling and laughing. So their performance really did seem to make a difference in your morale. Now, Roy Rogers and Dale Evans might be kind of news to people, but I think everybody in the United States knew that Bob Hope went to entertain the troops. So you saw Bob Hope also. Yeah. How did that go?
Yes. You know, it was interesting because I wasn't really going to go, but I happened to wind up after the Enclave section broke up, they sent me down to Saigon, you know, deciding where to put me next, you know. And they broke up the unit and people went to all other areas. And I'm waiting, and here comes Christmas and the Bob Hope show. And so it's a huge field out at the airport, Tansanoot Airport, and it's been raining, so everything's muddy. And you're sitting there waiting. And, you know, I might have been 100 yards away or something. And I'm sitting next to this, I guess he was an Air Force general or something. And he's sitting, and after a while, he just sits in the mud, and we're both sitting in the mud, you know? And then finally, Bob Hope comes on with some girls and stuff, and there's, you know, entertaining us. And I was a little disappointed because I see he's reading off cue cards. I don't know what I'm thinking, but I thought, you know, he was going to be spontaneous. No, he's reading everything. Somebody else wrote this stuff. I don't know. But he did a good show, and it was a morale boost. And, you know, we enjoyed it very much. But, you know, there was probably 75,000, 80,000 people there. So you don't really get, you know, the full effect. Like I did when we saw Roy Rogers, we were real close. It's not all. But, you know, it's good. I'm happy. I'm glad I saw him. And, you know, it was a good show.
Well, that served to boost morale.
Right.
And then when you were still there with Sadell, and you'd set out some rat traps to check for plague, and you check the pH in the water supply, give vaccination to children.
Yes.
And, you were giving them education on their health. And so you're busy.
Yes, I am.
But then there was something that happened. A bridge had been blown up. A convoy hit hard. So these medevac choppers are coming in and flying out the dead and wounded. Mm-hmm. And you say it's an eerie scene of calm and quiet after the storm
right.
you just seen.
Right.
And you said there were some dead Viet Cong.
Right.
Up near the river. So how did you experience this scene, Phil?
Well, you know, I look closely to see if they're still breathing. And if they are, what? Let them die or kill them or, you know, try to save them? And so, you know, we close the eyes of the dead Americans and position them nicely before they're placed into body bags or underneath the rain ponchos, ready for transport back to the what they call GR, Graves Registration, which just so happened to be right next to the tent where I was at up in Enclave. They call GR, Graves Registration. And after any major operation out in the field, a deuce and a half big truck would come in and carry the dead GIs to GR, Graves Registration. And the bodies are prepped and tagged, iced down into the reefer, which is a refrigerated tent. And they put into a plane, and they fly them down to Saigon. And then, you know, they process them and they put them into these interlocking aluminum caskets stacked onto a loaded trailer and put them on an airplane in the cargo hold, aboard the Freedom Board. Everybody who's going back home in their cargo hold are the dead bodies of American GIs. And, you know, so I'm looking at these dead guys and I'm thinking, oh my God, did they know they were gonna die? And what were their plans? And, you know, what did they eat? And you know, they're never gonna have another breath in their life, or never gonna, you know, brush their teeth or be with a loved one again. And you just wonder what they thought, because you're looking at them and they're young, dead GIs. And so, you know, it's just very, very upsetting. You know, you just look at them and they look, you know, like they're young guys. And what are their plans after surviving Vietnam? You know, what were they going to do? Go back to school, get married, have kids, you know, be mothers and, you know, be with their fathers. And anyway, so it's just after a while, you feel an overwhelming sense of sadness and a loss. So who I was up until then, and this random act of violence, the surprise ambush, the terror, the bloody mess, it's just, you know, it just changes you. It changes you, and you know, you just feel numb. After that, you just feel numb and never quite the same.
This is Philip Elkins, also known as Señor Felipe when he's making salsa. And he's telling us about scenes from his book, My Year in Vietnam, How I Managed to Survive June 1966 to June 1967. And he's just described a scene that is so hard to take. And what I enjoyed a lot that I enjoyed about your book, Phil, was you tell us what's going on inside you, because a lot of war movies, you see the battle scenes and all the drama, but I enjoy hearing how you felt, how when you saw these things, what were you feeling? How did that affect you? And I just before, just a few days ago, I came across an article in Smoke Jumper magazine. The title of the article was My Year in South Vietnam. And it's, of course, it's only an article. It's much shorter than your book. But it was more about what happened. And you tell us what happened, but you tell us then how it affected you. And I was just thinking, gosh, Phil, I wish they would. I first thought, I wish they would make a movie, but then I thought, no, a movie wouldn't be long enough. What I would really like is they would make a series.
Oh, cool.
Turn your book into a series that we could binge watch.
Oh, yeah. That'd be terrific. I would love doing that. Yeah. Well, you know, like this book, of course, I should mention, is available on Amazon, you know, and that was my second book, but I'm just releasing my third book. It's called Coming Home from the War in Vietnam, and talks about how I dealt with readjusting to civilian life and dealing with PTSD. And, you know, the hardest thing, really, everybody's so excited about coming home, but was the treatment, the disdain and contempt toward Vietnam veterans and how I dealt with that.
Well, I remember that all too well, because that was my generation. My girlfriends had their boyfriends going to Vietnam.
Right.
And it was so heartbreaking the way these men were treated, because World War II, everybody came home at once. The war was declared over. They were heroes. They all came home at once. And here these guys come in pretty much one at a time. And now, though, it's gone kind of overboard. One veteran said, you know, I really get tired of people saying thank you for your service. It's just so automatic. There doesn't seem to be much sentiment behind it. It's just an automatic.
You know, for 30 years after I got back from Vietnam, nobody asked any question. Nobody wanted to talk about it. But just a couple years ago, my girlfriend, Nancy, bought me a Vietnam veteran hat. And, you know, I felt a little uncomfortable wearing it. It's like, okay, no hiding it now. And, you know, people would say, thank you for your service. And it's like, well, that would have been nice, you know, right after I got home. But it didn't happen, you know. And now, yeah, I do wear it. And it's, you know, it's a nice feeling when people recognize, you know, that you did do something, you know, that deserves appreciation, because for a long time, no, as a matter of fact, my girlfriend at the time asked me why I had a Vietnam veteran sticker on my car. You know, it was, this was 30 years ago. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, somebody gave it to me, I put it on, but, you know, now, yeah, it's nice. It's nice to get the appreciation, even though it's, you know, a little late, but still, it's nice to people being nice of, to, you know, for so long they weren't. And you know, every movie you saw and every TV show was a crazy Vietnam veteran.
Yeah. Well, I began to wonder, how could anybody not be crazy? How could anybody come home sane after witnessing what you witnessed, Phil?
Yeah, it's true. It changed me, you know. My dad, I got a couple of swords I sent home from Vietnam, and I put them up on the mantle. And my girlfriend at the time took them out. She said, look how pretty they are. My dad said, no, you can't do that around Phil. You can't take that around Phil. Because I was pretty excitable back then, you know. And you know, you know, it took a while to adjust. But, you know, writing these books has been good therapy for me.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, you just mentioned your girlfriend, and so there you are in Vietnam, and your girlfriend back in California, your parents, your brother back in California. So what was, and I hesitate to call it love life, because I don't think that's what you soldiers went out looking for, love, but you found it.
Yes,
I found it, and not just once, but twice.
Twice, I know, they both happen to have the same name, named Lily. I know. I would get free time occasionally, you know, and so, you know, you wind up involved with the locals, you know, and of course you go to the bars and you meet these girls, and you know, not all of them are prostitutes, and so you know, but basically what they want to do is leave Vietnam and come to the U.S., you know. And so, you know, they would spend time with you and please you. And you would, you know, you're lonely and you're looking for love and you fall in love, you know. And then, you know, pretty soon you get very involved emotionally with them. And you start thinking, maybe this is the answer to my troubles. But yeah, I was lucky. You know, not everybody was lucky like that. I was lucky.
Well, since both your girlfriends were named Lily, you had to give them a number. And first place and second place sometimes were interchangeable. But one you did meet at a bar, but one you met at an orphanage.
Yes.
And how was she different from, say, the girls you met in the bars?
She was so sweet and so kind and so loving. And, you know, we were just talking and she invited me to her parents' house for dinner. And, you know, I'm wearing my funky fatigues and they're all dressed real nice. And she's just doing just really nice, inviting me and feeding me. And then her father made this homemade alcohol. And, you know, he offered it to me and I got real drunk. I got real drunk and I'm, you know, I'm not sure what to say. And, you know, he would ask me questions and, you know, I would try to answer them. And you know, I'm drunk. But go ahead.
On a different occasion, you want to spend a little time with Lily without the rest of the family, with just her. So you say, hey, Lily, how about we take a walk?
Exactly.
How did that turn out?
I want to get away from the parents, and she's got a little brother and little kids that are being bratty, you know. And I thought, well, how am I going to get to know her? So I said, let's take a walk. And she talks to her mom and dad, and she said, okay, we could take a walk. So who comes? The mother, the father, the grandmother, and the little kids. And we're taking a walk. It's not like I could hold her hand and, you know, and really get to know her that well. So every once in a while, she would sneak away and we would, you know, have some time together alone. And that was very, very nice and special and unusual. But you know, those are the good memories.
On another occasion, you wanted to get gifts. And so you remember the mother, or the dad, the brother, and of course, Lily. But you forgot the grandmother, Phil.
Right. She's a matriarch, right? You forgot her. I got the father cigarettes, a couple cartons of cigarettes, and, you know, little kids, little toys and stuff, her little brother and sister, and then, you know, flowers and jewelry, but not the grandmother. Oh, God. Well, what do you get to a grandmother? I don't know. So I couldn't remember, but, you know, that was a mistake. But it was good.
My guest is Philip Elkins, and he has written a book, a memoir, My Year in Vietnam, How I Managed to Survive June 1966 to June 1967. After a break, Phil Elkins and I will continue our conversation about his year in Vietnam. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And I'm back with author Phil Elkins. We're talking about his year in Vietnam. There's another surprise action where you're faced with people who have died, and there they are. And you're a medic now, so
right. You
are supposed to come to the rescue of people. And
right.
This was unexpected. There you are. You're sleeping at the place where you're staying with your unit.
Right.
And what happened in the middle of the night?
Right. Well, we get hit by mortars, and, you know, people would get hurt. And then this one guy, actually the airplane, you talking about the airplane crash? The airplane
yes.
crash?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah.
And this wasn't an airplane that you were in. It wasn't that crash.
No, just a transport airplane came in and crashed into our unit. And there was this one guy, did not like me at all. And I see he's hurt. And, you know, I'm thinking, okay, what do I do with this guy? Let him die? You know, so I thought, okay, well, you know, I try to do resuscitation. And finally he looks at me and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, you know, I'm trying to save you. And he, you know, he was mean. He didn't like me. You know, some people like you, some people don't. And I did manage to save him, although I struggled with it. I thought, well, you know, he's dying. I'm not going to save him. But yeah, that's what happened. The airplane came in and crashed and a bunch of people got hurt. And our unit was in shambles. And, you know, that was another time, you know, we were lucky, but I managed to survive that. And, you know, the funniest thing was my year, you're counting your days, you know, and you want to go home. And the couple of weeks before I'm ready to leave, the commanding officer calls me and I thought, oh, I'm in trouble. Well, now what? And they try to talk you into staying. I couldn't believe he was serious. You know, see, one of the things about the war was it wasn't a declared war. It was considered police action. So if it's ever declared, just like World War II, you're there for the duration. You're not going home until the war is over. It's like, oh, no, thank you. I'm not taking any chances. I'm going home. They said, look, if you extend a few months, you get out early. It's like, no, thanks. I'm not taking that chance.
Well, one thing they wanted you to do, because you were so good at, it's kind of a performance you put on to get right. The guys interested in what you had to say to take care right. of themselves. Uh-huh. And so they bring in this new guy and you don't get along with him.
No.
What happened between you and your supposed trainee?
He was quite a bit bigger than me and he didn't like me. He said, look, first of all, I'm Jewish, and he starts to bad-mouthing Jews, and it's like, he thinks I got nothing to teach him, and so I thought, okay, well, you know, forget it, you do it on your own. Well, the commanding officer comes in and said, did you teach him anything? He thinks he doesn't need to learn anything, and so finally, he gets angry at me. So I said, look, how about you do some wrestling? You know, and well, you know, he's
well, got before wrestling, I thought you were expecting to box with him because you felt like, yeah, boxing, I've got a chance against this big guy. And he's the one, as I recall, he's the one who said, hey, let's wrestle instead of doing boxing.
Oh, you know, he slammed me down real good, real quick, and sits on top of me. It's like, you know, he had me by 50 pounds, you know, and plus he was a wrestler in high school, you know. It's like, what do I know? I just know, you know, street fighting. I don't know about wrestling, you know. So, we you know, he gets me down a couple of times, and then, you know, he badmouths me, and didn't think I could teach him anything. And then the commanding officer says, well, did you teach him anything? I said, well, let me teach him anything. So he got in trouble, you know, because.
Oh, but he was very apologetic, Phil. Oh, I'm so sorry I called you names. So sorry I wrestled you. And please, I'm supposed to learn from you. And I've got to do it before tomorrow. Please, I'm so sorry. Yeah.
I said, look, I'm tired. I got to take a nap. Yeah. No, you know, you know, there are some mean people out there, and he was one, and he figured, you know, I had nothing to teach him. So it's okay. You do it on your own. And the commanding officer got mad at him.
You must have been a little bit pleased when he gets up to take his turn at giving this health talk, this lecture. And
yes.
He's terrible at it.
He's terrible. He is terrible at it. And the guys are yawning. They're not listening. They're talking to each other. He said, what happened? What happened? I said, you got to entertain them. You got to catch their interest. You can't just talk a lecture. You know, they're not interested in listening to a lecture, you know. So
there's a lot that I don't want to tell people because I don't want to spoil it for your readers. Mm-hmm. But I did like the way you told us how you feel when you're in a situation. For example, when that plane crashed into your unit, and you said, these are real people, at least they were. These were real, alive people. These weren't nobodies. And they were important people, weren't they? And then this is when you say, I wander around trying to be helpful, lost in a daze. How will I ever be the same again? How will I ever be that young man I was before I was drafted into this insanity?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So I'm imagining that in order to tell this story with such detail, and you quote conversations, you must have kept a journal. You must have written down a lot of what you experienced, because I couldn't remember all these details and things in my life. Is that what you did when you were there in Vietnam?
I wrote a lot of letters. So, you know, you live for letters, okay? And so I'm writing what, you know, I did. And they saved the record, my letters. And I looked through them. And I still got them, you know? And I said, oh, that's right. That's right. Oh, I better remember. I better write about that. And I take notes, you know? And then what happened was my mom died. And 4 months later, my dad died. And I missed him. And I wanted to feel close to him. So I just started, you know, as a child, and just, it was like therapy. I just like relived my life and looking at the letters that I wrote and the letters back. And, you know, I just, it would spark memories. Oh, that's right. That's what happened, you know? And then I would just relive it. I was really just reliving the whole experience all over again.
Well, you do say that this was the year, and it starts in June of 1966, ends in June 1967. So you do make it back to what you guys call the world.
Right, exactly.
You do make it back. I mean, people can assume that because here you are talking to us.
Yes, I made it back. Yes, I did.
But I do appreciate your writing this, because I think so many veterans could not bring themselves to do what you have done. So thank you, Phil.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, I knew people that wouldn't take one picture. They threw everything away. They didn't want to have any memories. And if I try to track them down, you know, I always thought, okay, you know, get together with, there's a couple of guys that, you know, I keep in touch with, email and stuff in LA that were in Vietnam with me. But for the most part, no, they just want to forget the whole thing ever happened. And for me, it was therapy to write. It was really, I just wanted to get it out. And I just would be a, first, you know, just every day. That's all I wanted to do. Everything else was a nuisance except writing.
And you have a talent for it. Well, you play guitar, don't you, Phil?
Yes, I do. And I teach guitar, right? Yes.
You teach guitar. You have a radio show where you play music for your DJ.
Yes,
and I know you spent some time on the stage because that's where many years ago I first met you. And that's when you introduced yourself as Senor Felipe, which I was too new to know about. But I hope you inspire others to explore their talents and make use of them. So,
I teach, like I said, I teach the guitar and a gospel music class, and I try to get them to write a song, you know, about something, you know. I always say, write what you know. Yeah, and that's why I was able to write these books, and also the songs. Write what you something that you feel. You got to write what you feel, and same thing with music, and sing it. You know, people know when you really got your heart into something.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that you are in the process of writing a new book. Can you tell us the title? You have a title for it?
Yes. It's called "Coming Home from the War in Vietnam." And it takes off where my year in Vietnam ends, and it goes on to what my life was, you know, trying to readjust a civilian life, and how, I thought life was going to be a cakewalk. I got home from Vietnam, everything going to be good. And, you know, people say, why'd you go? And that kind of thing. It's like, why'd I go? Well, it was either that or go to prison. It's like, you know, and then I went to college, East LA College, and then Cal State LA, and there's all this anti-war stuff, you know, and I got involved in that, in the anti-war marches and protest movement, and the book talks about how I readjusted and became a hippie, big long hair and a big beard, and then when I was in college, the teachers thought, well, you're just trying to avoid getting drafted. And I said, I've already been drafted. I had to show my discharge papers. You know, they thought I was trying to avoid the draft. I said, I've already been to Vietnam. They didn't want to believe it, you know. And then I wound up in Canada. I met a girl, you know, while she was hitchhiking. And people up in Canada thought I was a draft dodger. And I said, I've already been there. They don't want to believe it, you know. And so the book "Coming Home from the War in Vietnam" talks about that and how I struggled with depression, anxiety, and PTSD, and went through a bunch of different relationships and marriage, a couple marriages and divorces, had kids.
One thing I might add for readers: you say you like the story to be as realistic as possible. So you caution the reader that there are some harsh words, some derogatory terms, graphic scenes in that book. So again, the title of Phil's book is My Year in Vietnam, How I Managed to Survive June 1966 to June 1967.
Available on Amazon.
The author is Philip Elkins. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I appreciate it very much. I love talking to you. You do a terrific job, and I appreciate it very much.
And now here's founding race director of the Almond Bowl Run Road Race, Walt Schaefer, to tell us about the Almond Bowl Run.
Thank you, Nancy. The Almond Bowl Run was one of the first events put on by the Chico Running Club when we were formed in 1975 in the summer. And we made a decision to do two things. The first was to have a major speaker come to Chico, Peter Snell, former world record holder of the mile. I can talk about him if you'd like. And the second was the Almond Bowl Run. And the Almond Bowl Run, we decided, would be the first Sunday in November. And it has been going on ever since, so 47 years. The Almond Bowl Run, 5K and a 10K run generally, sometimes a half marathon. So go to chicorunningclub.org and you can read up how you can register for the Almond Bowl Run. It's conducted in Bidwell Park, and it's a really fun event. You can run it as a jogger, or you can run it very competitively, whichever you choose.
Now, you mentioned Bidwell Park, and I think that's a major attraction for people who are looking for a community to move to in California. I know it was an attraction for my husband and me many years ago, that here was this park, one of the largest municipal parks in the United States, that was a place for families to get together and exercise and enjoy nature. And so you were one of the founders of the Bidwell Classic, as well as the Almond Bowl.
Yes, I was. We decided then that spring of 1976 to start the Bidwell Classic. And at the beginning, the first year was held, we started it at Hooker Oak, where the fun run started at that time. And it was a 3 mile and a 12 mile. And then the next year we decided to make it a marathon and a half marathon and a 5K run. And our co-sponsors, by the way, were the Chico Lions Club, Breakfast Lions Club, who provided a lot of manpower and publicity and encouragement. And from that point on, we had a marathon for several years. The half marathon has gone on ever since at 1 mile. And I might just add about Hooker Oak. I mentioned Hooker Oak. You know, Hooker Oak is in the logo of Chico Running Club, as it is Chico Rotary Club and others. And we always met in the parking lot of Hooker Oak. And on May 1st, 1977, Hooker Oak toppled over. It had been a huge part of Chico's image and heritage. And that was a real jolt. It was 111 feet from the trunk to the tip of the largest branch. It was over 110 feet tall. It was historic, and that was a real jolt. And I, by the way, collected a piece of bark that I still have as a memento. It's about 6 inches thick, and that was pretty sad when Hooker Oak toppled over, and it was an important part of the world of the Chico Running Club back in those days.
Professor Walt Schaefer is the founding race director of the Almond Bowl Run Road Race. And we'll be looking forward to this year's Almond Bowl Run. Thank you, Professor Schaefer.
Thank you, Nancy.
I would also like to thank my first guest, author Phil Elkins, who wrote a book about the year he spent in Vietnam. The title, My Year in Vietnam.
Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.